Hello, Gallatin Valley. Thank you again for listening to KGVM 95.9 FM and KGVM.org. I'm Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist, with Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist. The topics today in this program, health and happiness, are so important that we're going to go directly to Suzanne now to introduce the topic and our special expert guest.
There's a lovely old song that was a major hit years ago. It was called "Love is a Many Splendored Thing." The song went on to say how love colored every sunrise and sunset and the many ways it could impact our lives. And today we're here to talk about another event that could impact our lives in a similar, invasive fashion and touch us in profound ways. We're talking about suicide among young people. This event strikes across our hearts and colors our days and our connections and our futures. It's pervasive, often leading to family breakdown, divorce, and separation, and statistically significant increase of suicide among that teen's acquaintances. It's hard to talk about, but heaps of research has been alerting us to the fact that it's far better to talk about it and more preventative to talk about it. So for suicide prevention, we're so honored and pleased to have with us today Carl Rosten, our statewide director for the support of suicide prevention. Welcome, Carl. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
We've just lived through a very traumatic event recently here, and we know that you hear of these at each and every turn. What are the current statistics among Montanans? I know that suicide is the second leading cause of death in people 10 years old to 20. It's the second leading cause of death in the U.S. And about 2.4 million considered suicide and 700,000 actually made a bona fide attempt, and that's nationwide. What could you tell us about Montana-wide, Carl?
Well, unfortunately, the news is bleak when we talk about Montana. And we always talk about, when we talk about the numbers, we talk about rates, because of our sparse population, numbers don't always tell us the story, but rate does. And the national rate of suicide for a young person, it's about 4.7 per 100,000. And this is over, because of the small number, even nationally, you have to go over more than just 1 year. So this is over the last couple of years, and that gives a more accurate description. But that number it's about 4.7 per 100,000 in the United States. Unfortunately, in Montana, our rate is more than three times that. It's about 13.2 per 100,000 in Montana. So our rate of suicide for our youth in Montana is much higher, as I said, three times higher than the national numbers are.
And it's something that might, in a way, sneak up on us unexpected. We're talking starting at age 10. That we have statistics. That's a shocking number to me, Carl.
It is. And, you know, the youngest in the United States last year was an eight-year-old. We haven't had that young in Montana. The youngest we've had is an 11-year-old. However, I am seeing more and more 11, 12, 13-year-olds. And then, you know, for instance, last year we had three 12-year-olds in our state who died by suicide. And that to me is horrible, is really a horrible number to look at.
You know, parents are so unaware. Just a couple of days ago, I mentioned to my daughter that we were going to be looking at talking about suicide among teenagers, and she has a 12-year-old and an 8-year-old, and she just said, "Oh, Mom, you know, like it's not time for us to even think about that yet." And her 12-year-old son came home from school the next day and said, "Mom, my friend," and this is somebody who comes over to their house a lot, "told his parents he was thinking about stabbing himself."
Yeah, it's unfortunately, it's getting younger. It's out of complete coincidence. This morning I got a call from a school counselor for an elementary school in Gallatin County, who asked if they could do a consultation with me because they had a fourth grader who was exhibiting self-harming behavior and making suicidal ideations. And so this was a 10-year-old, and this wasn't the first time that this student had been doing this. So it's unfortunate that the ideations and the thoughts are starting to get younger and younger in many of our kids.
Well, of course, kids could just talk about it. We don't have to pay attention to that. We could just laugh it off and say, "Oh, they don't really mean it." What do you think about that approach, Carl?
Yeah, and unfortunately, that's a really dangerous approach to take, because it's often a cry of help, and there's usually an underlying issue that's there. And many times, you know, sometimes we see it might be a modeling behavior. There might be either an older sibling, or even in the parents, there might be some misbehavior. Or it could be a sign of an underlying trauma that the child is starting to act out, or a kind of an early onset of a mental health issue. Often it's anxiety that can occur at a very young age. But I think that's one of the most dangerous things that happens. We know that the average age of onset for anxiety is around age 11. And even for some social phobias, it's as early as age 6 or 7. And I think that's one of the things that parents really have to be careful of. And matter of fact, if we take a look at what the national recommendations are now, then the national recommendations are now calling for universal screening for both depression and anxiety starting at age 12. Because we know that early identification has the best prognosis. And so this thought that it's too young to take a look at it is just not true anymore. We really need to start to identify this thing, these symptoms at an early age and start addressing them early so they don't become an issue at 15 to 24 when they really become a major, major issue.
Absolutely. And we realize sometimes there's no notice at all. We had one mother visiting with us on the show about losing her son who died by suicide here in Bozeman years back now, but she had no clue. So sometimes we need to be more intuitive and try to figure out if our child is feeling withdrawn or what are some of the signs that parents could look for that would tell us, okay, we need to be alerted, we need to do something?
Well, and the biggest thing is that we're looking for a change in character. We're looking for changes in how they usually are. They're acting different. And many times, you know, people often ask me, are the warning signs different for an adolescent compared to an adult? They really aren't. They're very similar. There's one primary one that is a little bit different, and that one is impulsivity, that kids tend to be more impulsive than adults do. But other than that, most of the symptoms are very similar. And we use a mnemonic called ISPATH WARM to remember the major warning signs. And the first part is I is ideation, where they start to communicate an intent of dying. And many times people think, well, Is it going to be a direct? Are they going to just say it? And very seldom is it. There's a huge amount of stigma attached to the issue of suicide, and very seldom is someone going to come right out and say it. They're much more likely to make an indirect statement like, I'm just a burden, or everybody'd be better off if I wasn't around, or I'm just tired of being here. Those are the things that people often say, but those are also the things we have a tendency to dismiss or minimize. There's also a myth out there that people who talk about suicide won't do it. That is false. What the current research is showing is once somebody communicates intent, you have a behavior usually within about 6 days. The S part of the IS path warm is substance abuse. And now this isn't as common in very young kids. This tends to be more of a factor starting in early adolescence. But either they start to use or they have an increase in the amount that they use of a substance. The P is purposelessness, no reason for living. Two things that we often see is they start to give away prized possessions, and it's whatever's of value to that child. It could be jewelry, clothes, money, art, music, but they start to give away things. And there's often also a deterioration in hygiene. We often see this, especially in adolescents, where they stop taking care of themselves. And the important thing here is to remember that it's a change. So we're not talking about a child who's always had issues around this. It is a change in this behavior. The A is anxiety, agitation, difficulty concentrating, lapses in short-term memory. They start to miss assignments or they start to forget things. That is out of character. And a big one that we often want to look for is change in sleep patterns. And it's any change in sleep. And this is one where we have to be careful because, you know, for many times we think of people that are depressed is that they sleep all the time, and that could very well be. But many times with adolescents, we see an agitated sleep, trouble falling asleep, trouble staying asleep, waking up many times during the night. And another piece of this is what we call T is for trapped, and that is a sense that's never going to get better. That it's always going to be this way. They think it's never going to change. And that leads to feelings of hopelessness, no future orientation, no goals. And they often start to withdraw. They start to pull away from friends. They stop communicating with family. And they often stop doing the things that they enjoy, whether it's playing video games, whether it's playing sports, hunting, but they stop doing the things that they enjoy. And there's often an increase in irritability or anger. They're often on edge, a lot of times you'll often hear a theme of revenge in some of their communications, because many times there's a relational component to this. And if there's a loss of a relationship, whether it's a girlfriend, boyfriend, or just a loss of any type of friendship, many times that there's a cognitive distortion that goes with the depression, where they think they're alone, that no one cares about them. So the relationships they do have are critical. So that loss of that in a relationship can be a major disruptive force in their lives. And then you can see an increase in reckless types of behaviors, and it could be more of high risk behaviors. It may be drug use. It could be it could be sexualized behavior. It could be lots of different types of high-risk types of behavior. But overall, that mood change that we talked about, a flat affect, depressed mood, acting out of character. And I want to go back to one thing that you said before. You mentioned that a lot of the parents don't see it. A lot of they don't think of it. Well, one of the stats that we know nationally is that about 86% of parents that lost a child to suicide didn't even know their kid was depressed. And that's because as parents, we lose our objectivity when it comes to our kids. It's hard for us to picture our child wanting to die. And I really want to emphasize this because one of the things that is really critical is to talk to your pediatrician and have your kids screened. Having your kids screened gives parents the information they need to be able to make the best decisions for their kids. But be looking out for these warning signs and work with your pediatrician on looking for the signs that are there.
So when you have your child screened by the doctor, how does that come about? What is that?
Well, they can, and by the way, it doesn't just have to happen in your pediatrician's office. A lot of the schools around Gallatin, Gallatin County and Clark County, Madison County, there are programs that we have where the screening can actually occur in schools as well.
Yes.
But there's a great program out of Livingston called the Rural Behavioral Health Institute that has screening that's done in schools, and it connects kids directly to care. But concerning your question, when you go into your pediatrician, there are very simple screening tools for both depression and anxiety. For depression, there's what's called the PHQ-A, and that's just a simple depression symptom checklist that's specific for youth. That is kind of a very well known tool that helps pediatricians and healthcare providers identify symptoms of depression. And then the what's called the GAD-7 is a well-known tool that identifies symptoms of anxiety, and there's a way of scoring them that helps identify if somebody is in a higher risk category, and all of them are basically just they're screening tools just as far as symptom checklists that should indicate whether further evaluation by a behavioral health professional is indicated or not.
Okay, good. So it's not a difficult, complex thing. It's a simple, straightforward way to get information then.
Oh, very, very easy, very straightforward.
Carl, that acronym you gave earlier, what is the H?
For the ISPATH Warm
ISPATH Warm. Uh-huh.
Oh, that's for anybody who is at risk for suicide. These are the warning signs we look for. And like I said, the big issue there is that we're talking about a change in character, and that's when I work with schools, in order to know if somebody is acting out of character, we need to know what their character is in the first place. So I always, when I'm working with schools, Mitch, I always emphasize to teachers, especially, get to know your students, because then you're going to know when they're not acting like themselves. But I think that's critical, that we get to know our students so that when something's not right, we're more aware of it.
And then speaking to teachers who are deeply concerned and enmeshed with all of this, if they notice a change, would they let the school counselor know or the family know? What would you recommend there?
Well, absolutely. And there was recently a state law passed, which I'm very excited about, just in this last legislative session. And it actually went into effect just last July. But all teachers are now required to have 1 hour of suicide prevention training every 3 years. And so they are now required to get some of this training. The other piece that is critical is that teachers are mandated reporters. So if they see a student that is struggling or is acting in a high risk, they should go immediately to their administrator or school counselor and notify them of what they are observing so that the administrator or school counselor can intervene.
And we can say absolutely that in the Gallatin Valley, the schools do have counselors. We had one on this show just very recently, and they're very concerned and would do everything they can to help so that parents could even, as you said, reach out to the school or the physician or... I think it would be good for us to mention the 988 lines right now. And
yeah, I'm really glad that you brought that up, because I cannot emphasize that enough. I'd like to talk a little bit about 988 a little bit. So for those in the audience that don't know about 988, 988 is a crisis line. It's a mental health crisis line. And we've had, it's basically been around for 50 years, but it used to be the 800-273-TALK. Well, in July of 2022, it was changed nationally to a three-digit number, the 988. And actually, since that time, Montana has one of the highest performing call center systems in the country. So we have three call centers in our state. We have Voices of Hope in Great Falls. We have the Help Center in Bozeman. And we have Aware in Missoula. And they split up the state kind of based on population density. But Gallatin County and 13 counties kind of surrounding Gallatin are covered by the Help Center. And they take in and they answer, they're responsible for the calls. And, you know, in, if you take a look at the data, and of course, this is for all ages or all population, but we've seen a dramatic increase in the number of people using 988, and that's a positive. In 2025, we had more than 16,000 calls come into the 988 system in Montana.
Oh, wow.
And what's important for people to understand, the way that system is meant to work, it's part of it's the national, what's called the Crisis Now model, where there's always someone to call. And that's the first part of the Crisis Now model. And so say you're in Bozeman and you call, and if all the phones are busy at the Help Center, it goes to the next available call center so that there's always someone there. It might be one of the other call centers in Montana. It might be a call center in Idaho. So, for instance, we get a ton of calls from Washington, California. We get calls from Florida and New York. The system is completely interlinked. So that resources, if someone called from California, they're connected. They're able to connect to California resources. But what's important to note, 97% of the calls that come into our call centers stay in state. So 97% of the time, people that call from Montana, they're talking to Montana people. That's actually the highest in the country. So that's important to know. The other piece that has changed, which is really critical, previously it used to be based on area code. In other words, it would go, if you called, say you had a California cell phone number, at first it would go to the call center associated with that area code. So as you know, we have a number of people that are transplants that have moved to Montana and may still have an out-of-state phone number. Well, previously, it would go to, say you had a California cell phone number, it would go to that cell phone or that call center in that area code. Well, that changed. That they have changed that to what's called now geolocation capability, where it now goes to the nearest cell tower. So that it's no longer based on area code. So it doesn't matter what your cell number is, it's going to go to the nearest cell tower.
That's so good to hear. Yeah.
Yeah. What that has done is really cut down on the answer time. So last year, we're answering the phone in about 9.6 seconds, which is well below the national benchmark of about 30 seconds. So we're not only staying in state, we're answering the phone very quickly, but now I want to talk about the most important part. In Montana, 83% of the calls that come in, the issue is stabilized on the phone. And I want you to think about that for a second. 83% of the calls, the issue is stabilized on the phone. Very few, only I think about 8% of our calls require 911 or crisis stabilization. What that tells me is that people just need someone to talk to.
Oh, wow.
That is critical. Mm-hmm. And the people, the counselors that answer the phones are trained professionals that can determine risk, and if need, they can activate the 911 system or crisis response. So this is one of the reasons that we really want to promote the 988 system as a viable resource for people 24/7, It's there for people to use and really needs to be promoted in our communities.
I couldn't agree more. And right now I'd like to dwell for a minute. I know the Help Center here in Bozeman. We have wonderful volunteers who get up in the evening, well, 24 hours a day, and they go in and they stay in a little section with a phone all night long. These are trained volunteers and professionals, and they are the ones heroically taking these calls, even though for them, it might be even hard on them to hear these things. They are there to help others. And we actually always need more volunteers to be willing to come and be trained in the specifics. And so that would be for the Gallatin Valley. The Help Center provides that training, that facility, and those people. I think it would behoove all of us as citizens to take by donuts, cinnamon rolls, a big box of chocolates, find out where this is, and let's support our people who are helping our children and our adults.
Carl, can you tell me the effect of social media on our youngsters, our people?
Yeah, there's so much stuff out there, and I think the biggest thing that I see is that I see kids especially are having their identity and self-concept tied to how many likes they get on a post or a picture, and I think it's so dangerous. Also, I think one of the dangerous things about social media is that people can be very cruel and mean, and you never have to face your victim. And I think that's one of the dangerous things about social media is that we can post something, we can say something that is cruel that we wouldn't necessarily say if we were face to face with somebody. And I think we don't understand the damage that does to people. And I think that's one of the real dangers that we have. And then if you have people that see that and they're, you know, I almost have an issue when they say it's social media, because in many times it's not very social. It's done in the middle of the night when they're sitting by themselves, when they should be sleeping, and they're all alone.
Yeah.
And that's not very social. It's a very isolated behavior in many ways, and they're not very connected. And there's not often someone there to help them or to process with it, or in some ways, there's no way for them to do a reality check to see what's really real. And I think that's where the danger really lies with social media.
That sounds so correct. I know that I have an article here about Instagram, and they're saying that they plan to alert parents when their teens search for suicide or self-harm information. And they said on June 6th of last year, I guess, soon we'll add new notifications to parents to help keep teens safe. Do you know where they've gotten with this yet, Carl?
I don't, and I think that's, I mean, that's nice for them to say, but how are they going to contact parents? I mean, many times parents don't have Instagram accounts, or the other thing that happens is kids have ghost accounts. And I think that's, it's nice to say that, but I'm not so sure how accurate they are, how much access they actually will have to parents.
I hear you. What would you say to parents about kids and their media, their phones, their computers? Have you got any advice for them, Carl?
Yeah, it's a balancing act, because kids, of course, need their independence and some privacy as far as being able to grow and earn trust. But I think when it comes to social media, I think I know that when my kids were at that stage, what I would say is that, yeah, you can have it, but I need to have access to your passwords. I promise that I won't violate that trust, but I do need to have access to it. And occasionally, I will ask you to go on. And as long as the passwords are changed, and as long as I don't find out that there's aren't any ghost accounts, then I will not interfere with that. However, if you violate that trust, then I'm going to shut it down. And I think there has to be that conversation up front, that there's a collaboration and cooperation between the child and the parent, that there's a mutual understanding, that there has to be a level of trust, or it's a privilege, not a right. Uh-huh. And I think that that's a discussion that all parents should have with their kids.
I was wondering, too, I was reading that it was recommended a phone could also be helpful to a young person because many of them carry phones 24/7 now. And if parents would talk to young people when they first start using a phone about 988 and put it in their phone and other numbers for emergencies that the kids might have with their friends or for themselves, would you recommend that, Carl?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course phones have a purpose that could be very beneficial. It's difficult though, because how do you cut off the dangerous part and still keep the helpful part? But I think, of course, 988 is one of interest. There's a tool that we use. There's a screening tool that we use for risk assessment called the Columbia Protocol. And it's actually an app that you can have on your phone. And it's interesting because one of the things that has recently happened with the Columbia Protocol, we're actually encouraging kids and adults, actually anybody, to actually have this app on their phone. It's a free app. And they can assess their own level of risk. But the most important part that they've added is that if they have their locator on, they can immediately have access to 988. They can just press a button and it'll contact 988. But also, they've tied this app in with the SAMHSA resource locator. That's a national resource locator. And so wherever they are, based on if they're an adolescent, whether they're a veteran, whether they're an elderly woman, they can actually identify mental health and behavioral resources nearest them, wherever they are. And so this is a very productive app that not only can assess risk, but have immediate crisis resources, but also identify local resources based on what their needs are. So there's definitely some very good resources out there. I also, one of the major tools that we use, especially with kids, are what are called safety plans, where kids can, where we have, like, when they're in crisis, coping skills that they can use, people they can contact, because we know that when we're in crisis, our problem-solving abilities diminish. We don't think clearly. So there's a number of wonderful apps around safety planning that they can have on their phone, including that it'll contact 988 immediately. But so those are the types of apps that I strongly encourage parents and youth to have on their phones. Those are very productive apps.
Excellent. And I wonder too, I think I've mentioned this before on this program many times, but I did a study or I read a study by a researcher who interviewed a number of people who had made a valid attempt to die by suicide and who had survived accidentally. Like they jumped off the bridge, but somehow somebody might have been right there and fished them out and saved them. And, you know, various scenarios like that. what the researcher found in, like, I think it was like 97% of these people, is that as they were getting ready to die, as they fell, or as whatever got started that they were going to end their lives, they realized completely they didn't want to die. It was the wrong choice. They wanted to live. And what they brought out of that is people are trying to escape the pain. It's that immediate pain that colors your thinking and your emotions. And so I know that you could talk to that, Carl.
Yeah, and what the numbers that you're coming from are coming out of what's called the Means Matter Project out of Harvard Public Health. And the data is pretty incredible. What we know nationally, 90% of the people who attempt suicide and live will not die by suicide. I want you to think about that.
Wow.
90% of the people who attempt suicide and live will not go on to die by suicide. Because one of the things we, and here's, this is where we really have to start talking about safe storage and of firearms and lethal means counseling. Because that 90% didn't use a gun. You don't get a second chance with a gun. By far the most common means of attempt is overdose. About 70 to 90% of all suicide attempts are by overdose, but it's the least lethal. Only about 3 to 11% of overdoses result in death. Whereas if somebody uses a firearm, it's about 93% of the time results in death. So that piece is critical. And that, you know, when we talk about Montana and even our kids, you know, Montana, you know, 60% of our youth suicides are firearms. That is substantially higher than the national, which is just over 40%.
And that we have three times as many kids as other states, as you said earlier.
Yeah, that is a major issue. And even nationally, about 55% of the suicides are by firearm. Montana, it's about 68% last year. And that piece is something we really have to talk about, because, and you know, just as the name suggests, means matter. And it's not about taking away or getting rid of. We're talking about recognizing a person who's at risk, and while they're at risk, until we can get them in a safe place, let's reduce access to those means so that they don't act impulsively. And of course, we're not even talking just about firearms. We're talking about medications as well. But it's just about making your home safe while that person is at risk. And then, of course, I'll go back to what we started talking about at the very beginning. If you're going to, in order to know they're at risk, you have to know the warning signs. You have to be able to assess them. You have to have them assessed by your pediatrician or have them screened in school, because otherwise we don't know. And so that piece of, first of all, knowing what the warning signs are, working with your pediatrician or your healthcare providers or your school, and then making sure that if you have a child that is at risk, make sure you're safe, your home is safe. A majority, 80% of the time a youth dies by suicide with a firearm, the firearm is owned by the parent. That is important information for people to know. Make sure that your homes are safe. And by the way, it's not even, we're not talking about hunting rifles and shotguns here. At least 85% of the time, we're talking about handguns. And so I always have to ask the question, what's a 12-year-old doing with unsupervised, being the key word, unsupervised access to a handgun? I think that is a critical piece that we have to start to ask.
I couldn't agree more, and we really need to work on this here in Montana. I have this information from Johns Hopkins research team. It mentions that threats of suicide are a cry for help, and we should take it very seriously. And they talked about a group of parents who develop a written contract with their children. In it, the child agrees to alert parents if they're starting to have thoughts of self-harm. The parents agree to help the child interrupt the behavior in a non-judgmental fashion. Examples of this could be as simple as taking them out to dinner and talking, or as intense as taking them to the emergency room for assessment and a possible inpatient stay. The important piece is the fact that your child knows you are approachable and non-judgmental when help is critically needed. And that was from Johns Hopkins.
Carl, I've also heard that contracts are not very effective. Where does it stand?
Yeah, and I think I worry about the whole, I mean, I think having the discussion with your child is critical. I think knowing the warning signs and are important. I think having the conversation is the most important piece. Whether a contract is there's not a lot of evidence to say a contract is in place is really reliable. The safety plan piece is the important piece. Because here's the problem, and I mentioned it when I talked about warning signs. The major difference between an adult and a child when it comes to warning signs is impulsivity. And there's some research that suggests that about a third, almost 30% of youth suicides occur within an hour of having the first thought. So that doesn't give you much time.
No.
And that doesn't matter whether you have a contract with your parents in place. If it's something that's impulsive, it doesn't matter whether you have a contract in place. I think in those moments, that's when it's important that we know about family history, that parents are aware of the warning signs, and whether your home is safe or not. It's that impulsivity that we really have to take a look at. And I think that's the dangers about using any type of contract, is that's not foolproof in any way, I believe.
I've heard about the most recent report of the suicide here of a young person was really very impulsive. And so you hit it right on the head from what I don't know the details of the case, but that's what I've heard.
And I know that over the years, it's always been sort of a mind construct, a mental construct, that you don't want to mention suicide because that might prompt it to actually happen. And that maybe you should just keep quiet about it. And we've talked about how wrong that is. But
yeah.
I have something here from the Kids Health magazine research that when someone attempts suicide and survives, people might be afraid of or uncomfortable talking with them about it. And so tell your teenager if they know someone who's had depression or a suicide attempt, that they should let them talk about it and they should be open about it and able to go with them in that conversation. What would you say about that, Carl?
We have to be able to use the words. We have to be able to ask them directly, are you suicidal or are you having thoughts of killing yourself? That myth of putting the idea in their head, there's not one ounce of research to support that. On the contrary, asking somebody directly if they're suicidal or having thoughts of killing themselves validates their pain. It creates hope. It reduces isolation. It creates a sense of connectedness. And I want to go one step further in that many times we use language like, are they having thoughts of hurting themselves? that's also a mistake because that's completely different. And we say that to kids a lot. Are you, how are you having thoughts of hurting yourself? One of the things we know about people when they're in crisis is they think very literal. No, I'm not thinking of hurting myself. I'm thinking of killing myself. We have to be able to use the words. And the more the reason about why we don't use the words is our own discomfort with it, not the person who's actually experiencing it. And so this is all part of that stigma that we have to get over. It's consistent in Montana and the Rocky Mountain region especially, but this is part of that stigma we have to start to challenge if we're ever going to address this issue.
Thank you for that. And I'm remembering, too, a mom was on the show talking about her son, how she could never end her life, even though she wanted to, because her son had, but it's because the impact on others around. And so maybe we could talk about, to folks out there who might be considering dying by suicide, that it, how that impacts the family, the school members, the teachers, everybody involved. Carl?
Yeah, I think what we really want, what you're talking about there, is that we want to focus on enhancing what we call protective factors, and there's a number. What, you know, we always talk about risk factors and protective factors, and where the research has really shown that we want to focus our time is on enhancing those protective factors. And there's a number of them that we always want to talk about. One, and one that is especially relevant to youth is that developing coping and problem-solving skills, resiliency skills, ability to deal with adversity. And we have a number of programs in our elementary schools and even some of our high schools that really focus on coping and resiliency skills. And there's so much research that shows that is actually a protective factor for when they get into higher risk ages in their middle, you know, their late 20s, early 30s. That's incredibly effective. Helping them identify reasons for living, whether it's family, friends. In Montana, a big one, especially among kids and adolescents, pets, animals. Mm-hmm. Do they adopt a horse? A cultural identity. This is a big one when we talk about our American Indian population, a sense of cultural identity. But support from family. You know, feeling connected to their family, access, or feeling connected at schools. We know that when schools, community, if there's a sense of connected, if they're involved in groups or sports, that that's a protective factor. Access to healthcare is so important, and of course, we've already mentioned this one, but reduce access to lethal means. Goodness, if anybody wants to look at some fascinating research, go take a look at the Means Matter out of Harvard Public Health, because it takes a look at programs worldwide. And there are programs in other parts of the world that have shown success in reducing suicide. And the number one way is reducing access to lethal means. And then, of course, even faith-based, religion or moral objections to suicide can be a protective factor. So really focusing on those protective factors and enhancing those is something that we really need to do more of, especially with our youth.
Absolutely. And I know Arliss often quotes a fellow a mental health expert named Yuri Bronfenbrenner, who simply said, everyone needs someone who's crazy about him or her. And so I think, you know, it might behoove us all, whether we're teachers, neighbors, grandparents, parents, that we make the children know that we care about them, that we reach out to make sure that they know somebody is crazy about them.
Absolutely. What's the saying? All you need is one adult in your life to make a positive influence, and that's what we need.
And going back to something I've talked about before, there was a book many years ago, I think it was written by or about by Truman Capote, called The Moore's Murders. And it was about two young men who embarked on killing. And they killed a whole family just because they could. And it turns out when Truman Capote looked into their lives, there was not one person for either of them, not a grandparent, a parent, a neighbor, a teacher. There was no one that connected to those kids, and somehow they connected up together. And so we just need to make our children feel golden and valuable, whether they're ours or not. They're all our children.
Absolutely. And one, we know that the number one factor, not just with youth suicide, but all school violence, is a lack of parental connectedness. And so that you're spot on there.
You had mentioned once before about the effect of, it sounds strange in some ways, but the effect of atmosphere on the level of percentage of suicide.
Elevation,
altitude. Yeah, I think that's still an area that I think needs a lot more research. I don't think we can say it's causal, but there's definitely a correlation. A lot of the studies are coming out of the University of Utah, and what they have found is that as we get higher in elevation, our brains produce less serotonin. And what we know is worldwide, at about 2,500 feet, we see a spike in suicides. In Montana, the average suicide occurs at about 3,500 feet. And there's been one significant research article that found that even your SSRIs, your antidepressants like Prozac, Lexapro, Citalopram, all those were less effective at high altitude than they are at sea level. So I think that's an area that we need more research. I also, and this is one that I would love to see research in. I think even wind has an effect on neurochemistry. And I would love to see, there was one article that we found in the 80s about it, but needs to be replicated. I think there's a number of factors that all could contribute to be in Montana that could be factors that we need to be more aware of.
And that's something I know you're working on a daily basis, Carl, is to bring forth any information that could help and support us. Do we need more counselors, psychologists, folks to help with mental health out there, Carl?
Well, we definitely have a lack. I think we've had an increase. We have a few more programs. Like, I know Carroll College now has an MSW program. So we are starting to have more social workers and counselors available. I think we still have a lack of psychiatrists, for sure. We definitely need more psychiatrists. I would love to see more of that. I know that one of the programs that is promising, Frontier Psychiatry over in Livingston, Dr. Eric Erzubi, is very promising as far as having better access to telehealth for telepsychiatry. Dr. Erzubi has done a wonderful job improving access to even some psych residents at through Yale University. But we definitely need more psychiatrists. And in addition to that, I think the difficult piece is serving our rural communities is hard. And I think what has to happen in those areas is we really need an integrated behavioral health approach where, we have primary care clinics in rural communities, but they need to be there needs to be an added behavioral health approach. In other words, if you have a clinic with a doctor and a nurse, there needs to be a counselor or a social worker added to that, so that every community has access to the behavioral health piece along with the healthcare piece.
How well are the politicians hearing what you're saying?
I think they hear it, but it always comes down to you know, there's who's going to pay for it type of stuff. And I think that's it is realistic. It's hard to justify sometimes the cost when there's such a sparse population in many of these areas. And I think it's just finding a balance and finding a way to deliver it in a cost-efficient manner, I think, is always an issue that is a reality.
We have probably 3 or 4 minutes left on the program. Can you maybe summarize again what you said? It's all so very important and so well spoken.
I think the biggest thing is for us to start to talk about this stuff. I mean, we have such the issue of stigma is so prevalent still, and I just every single day when I hear stories, it's still about people who don't want to talk about the issue of suicide. I still hear about people feeling that they're a burden, or if they have depression or they have anxiety, that they're holding their loved ones back or they're hurting those around them. And we have to start to talk about this and confront this stigma. That there are resources out there, and we have to start to challenge ourselves to talk about these issues. Depression is treatable and suicide is preventable. And we definitely have, if nothing else, please, people, use the 988 number, because it is an incredible resource that is proven effective.
What kind of training did you have to go into this work? How would you recommend young people who want to help with this look at education and preparation?
Well, I think there's a number of behavioral health degrees that can qualify, whether it's psychology, social work, counseling. But I think you go into it, and there's starting to be more and more. I mean, I personally, when I went through graduate school a billion years ago, it was suicide wasn't even taught. It wasn't a required course. I remember there was an elective course on it. But I think part of what needs to happen is it needs to be required. Because I just think it's something that needs to be, that anybody who goes into behavioral health needs to be exposed to, because it's just a reality. I think also there needs to be more of this type of training in the medical field. I feel very fortunate that I work very closely with most of the nursing programs in the state. I just was down at Montana State last week training nursing students, and I have a wonderful relationship with the nursing department at Montana State, and train all their nurses in suicide risk assessment. And I feel like that should be required. They choose to have me come down. I don't think it should be a choice. I think it should be a requirement.
Yes.
But that stuff, I think that's one way of addressing the stigma. Is that if people are with some issues, if people are given the choice, they will avoid it because of the stigma. And I think the only way we challenge that stigma is sometimes when we're made to do stuff and then we see it's not so scary after all.
Carl Rosten, thank you very much. This has been incredibly informative. Gallatin Valley, remember 988. Work on these aspects of prevention of suicide that were talked about today. We hope you come back and listen again to Health and Happiness, 95.9 KGVM. Thank you.